Hi everybody, I'm Long Shoes on the line. I bet it's a very busy lady, and we are blessed to have her. Zane Busby, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much.
You have such an interesting, a passion, I think, in your life that you've been pursuing here to help so many people, the survivor of the Holocaust. How did that all come about?
Well, you know, I'm a comedy director by trade, so my career has been mainly in directing sitcoms, you know, everything from Golden Girls and Blossom and Newhart and Married with Children, all those things. And then during a break from shooting, just a two-week vacation about 14 years ago, I went on a roots trip to just see where my grandmothers were from. They were both from Eastern Europe, one from Lithuania, I thought, and one from Belarus. And when I was there, poking around the, you know, the back roads, trying to find these little tiny towns, I encountered Holocaust survivors who were living in extreme poverty. And that just wasn't right. So I started collecting those names, and I was helped by David Katz, who's a professor in Lithuania. And we started amassing more and more names of people to help. And when I came back to L.A., I started sending them money just a little bit at a time, and not even knowing if they would know who I was, or, you know, I didn't know the language, so I would just wrap up some bills and put a heart in an envelope and, you know, send it off. And then they started writing back to me things that were just astounding, like, your letter was a gift from destiny, and, I can't believe that I'm no longer alone. And I realized that just reaching out to these people and letting them know that no one has forgotten them just made their lives so much better. And then sending financial aid gave them the food, the medicine, the heat, and the shelter that they need and deserve.
And so what gave you the thought to start recording their memories about that tragic period of their life?
Well, in the beginning, when I didn't have any way to communicate with them because I didn't know Lithuanian or Russian or Yiddish or any of those languages, finally I got some translators and was able to write them letters and ask them specifically, you know, what happened to you during the Holocaust? You know, where were you the day the war started? What were your dreams and hopes before the war? Because everyone has dreams and hopes. And they started writing back, you know, these 10 and 15 page letters that were just amazing because no one had even asked them before what happened to them. So they spilled out all these incredible stories about their lives before the war and their wartime experiences and what happened to their families and then what happened post-war and, you know, if they were alone or they hid in the forest or they fought as partisans or they were in the ghetto or they escaped the death squads. Every single one of them had an amazing story, and I thought, I just have to keep recording them. You know, no one has these stories. They're just amazing.
So I'm assuming you hired a crew in Europe and just shot it there. How did you start to, what were the mechanics for you at the beginning?
Originally, it was just me and a camcorder, and that went on for years. And then I contacted a few people who came as volunteers, and we started to get like one camera man and then two. And then my last trip I just finished, which was it was in March. And I brought a cousin who's also a camera person and a student from the School of Visual Arts in New York. So with Noam Osband and Alex Echeverria, we were able to really capture some wonderful footage of these people in a professional manner.
Have you started to form them as a network together? Have you, you know, created somewhat like a new family for them?
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, our overall documentary, which will be, years in the making, is really called A Family of Strangers, because what's happened with these people who have no family or who have one or two relatives is we've become their extended family. We started with 8 survivors, you know, way back, and now we've helped over 2,000 survivors that we've communicated with. So all these people have been brought in from loneliness and despair to become part of a family where we communicate with them, we talk to them, we send letters, they write back. So it's been a joyous experience all around.
Have you helped track down if they were looking for missing family members and you were able to help them? Have there been stories like that over the last 14 years?
You know, some of them remember that a mother or a father had a brother who came to America in the early 1900s, but they don't have, a place or a first name.
Right.
But in terms of what happened during the Holocaust, they know what happened to their families. They may not know the details, but they know their parents were killed. They know their brothers and sisters were murdered. Sometimes they saw this, and so they really do know that there's no extended family left from before. I mean, some of them were sent to Siberia thinking that was a death sentence, only to come back and find out that, a week after they were deported, their entire villages were wiped out. 80 family members, 100 family members, 40 family members. So these are really the last of their families. A lot of them sole survivors of their families, and many of the last Jewish people in their town or village. So when they go, unfortunately, 1,000 years of history goes with them because they're the only ones who know what happened in that town.
I'm asking, some married over the year and had children and grandchildren. Are their grandchildren even familiar with their stories?
Yes. When you go over to those countries, the war is very close. It's like it happened yesterday. Everything is marked by before the war and after the war. And, they do. Some of them did marry. Some of them, their boyfriends and girlfriends, their fiancés, husbands and wives were killed, especially the men on the first day of the war. The Germans and the collaborators always killed the strongest first so that they couldn't protect the older people and the women and the children. So that was the systematic, extermination.
Wow.
Get all the young men first. Anyone who could fight was executed immediately. And then they went, through the list, old people, women, children. And so they do know what happened. And, some of them did remarry and had children. A lot of those children, there's no work for them, so they go either into Russia or they emigrate somewhere,
mm-hmm.
But they live at home and are more of a financial burden because there's no work. So these families are very poor if they do have families. And a lot of them are ill from Chernobyl because Chernobyl was not only in Ukraine, but it infiltrated into Belarus and surrounding countries. And we have a lot of second generation, cancer victims and people who are not well as their older, relatives.
Any idea of when a documentary will be shown to the public? Or I imagine it just matter when you think it's ready.
Well, we have one program airing now that's been accepted for Emmy consideration in three categories, and that's called The Last Survivors: Echoes from the Holocaust. And in that TV special, we show the stories of the survivors, and some of these are read by wonderful actors: Edward Asner, Francis Fisher, Elliot Gould, Valerie Harper, Leni Kazan, Alan Rosenberg. They're just astounding stories, and the performances are absolutely riveted. And the rest of that special is the efforts on our part to bring them emergency aid to these are forgotten heroes who really, really need help in the last years of their lives. So that can be seen at survivormitzvah.org. You just go to that website and click the graphic and you can see that whole thing. The longer documentary could be a series. It could be a series of documentaries because we've been filming for, years,
mm-hmm.
over 10 years. And that would require funding to bring it to its final, fruition. So we're looking for that because it's an important document, because we have some of the only existing footage of things like wooden synagogues, which have now fallen down, and survivors' stories who have now passed on. Because these were the survivors from the East. I mean, here in America, we know pretty much a lot about the concentration camps and Central Europe and what happened under the German influence. But the stories from the East were under Russian rule until pretty recently, and so those were suppressed. So the Holocaust in the East is a very little-known subject. It's really the story of survivors who faced what's called the Einsatzgruppe, which was a German mobile killing squad that fanned out across Eastern Europe that, went, instead of bringing Jewish men, women, and children to concentration camps to murder them, they did it on the spot. So they went into every town and village, rounded up the people, killed them, and then torched the villages. So these are the people who have those stories.
Wow. Any idea roughly for, because what you have is such wonderful, is such important history, I'm thinking of as an archivist. Have you decided when you might have it as a depository, just in case, you know, historians want to look at 300-400 years from now?
That's the whole point. We have the Survivor Mitzvah Project Holocaust Educational Archive, and in that archive we have all of the footage and all of the letters. We have about 10,000 letters
wow.
and documents and photographs and things like that. And what we want to do eventually with funding is to make it an educational tool and make it available to students and teachers worldwide so that everyone can learn the stories of these people who, really, that's their legacy to future generations. You know, if we forget about this stuff, then it could happen again. So their legacy, because they don't have things to give us, they have their stories to give us. So it's in a very important archive that we want to catalog and have the funding to preserve and edit together all of the video so that, you know, it'll be a clickable archive so that students and teachers worldwide will be able to access it.
You mentioned that you started to help them out financially right off the beginning. I'm assuming that continued. Have you done fundraising to keep that kind of
part? We fundraise all the time, and we have a website where you can click to donate. We do live readings of with famous actors. I mean, everyone from Chris Noth to Ron Rifkin, and as I said, Elliot Gould and Francis Fisher and Valerie Harper has done a few of them. David Eigenberg, who's on Chicago Fire. I mean, a lot of wonderful actors have stepped up to the plate and told their stories, which always raises funds. And now with the 1 hour television special, everyone has a chance to really see that in person and donate if they wish. You can even text to donate now. You can text the word giving and you can donate. So there's a lot of ways that people can help, because these are truly the last survivors of the Holocaust, and we are truly the last generation that can help them.
Yeah.
So if you want to do something about the Holocaust, there's still time to do something, because these people really, really need aid. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to change their life and tell them they're not forgotten. You know, we've saved people's eyesight. We've given them operations so they can walk again. I mean, we have literally changed the life of so many survivors, and we don't do it alone. We do it with people who donate. I mean, the donations are the only thing that keeps their lives going. So it's a wonderful thing to be able to do something, and I hope that more people will join in, because time is running out. If people would like to text, you can text the word giving to 41444. You just text giving to 41444, and you can give any amount.
You have a Facebook page?
Yes, we have a Facebook page called Friends of the Survivor Mitzvah Project. And we have a website with all kinds of information. You can read the stories. You can see the videos. So there's lots of information. And when people, it's interesting, just like when I went there the first time, I had no idea there were Holocaust survivors still struggling and suffering in Eastern Europe. I thought that, you know, all the survivors were taken care of by organizations and charities, and most of them had moved on to the United States or Canada or Israel. But it's not the case. You know, so many of them got stuck there when the Iron Curtain fell that when you see their faces, which we show in all of our videos that we make, and there's a ton of videos on our site, and you actually see them and you see them in their daily lives and you see the poverty, it really moves people to help, because once you see it, you just can't turn away.
When do you decide to make a trip to Europe? You wait till you have so many that you think you want to shoot? How do you figure out one to go?
Well, I personally like to go in the winter for a couple of reasons. I like to see how they're faring in the winter, because a lot of these places have no heat, or they have broken windows, or they don't have, you know, the huts. A lot of them live in huts in the villages, and the huts were made of, they usually built them themselves, or they're very, very old, like 100 or 150 years old, and they require maintenance because they're made of straw and mud bricks. So when they were all younger, you know, every, you know, spring, they would repair the bricks and fix the walls and do that. But now that they're elderly, they can't repair these things, so huts are falling down, and, you know, they still, so a lot of them don't have indoor plumbing. So I like to go in the winter just to see how they're faring. And during that time, I also have more access to translators and guides, because a lot of those people are school teachers over there. and they're off during the winter, you know, the holiday months. And so we're able to really get a good group to go around and talk to the people, find new people, visit the people that we've been helping, and see how they're doing.
Then, if you notice something needs to be fixed and repaired, are there an agency in Europe that you go to, or do you arrange for the local? How do you help with a physical need like maintenance?
Yeah, there's no agency over there that helps. I mean, these people are literally aging in place without the benefit of health care.
Yeah.
No social services. They don't have, like, assisted living in old age homes. They don't have any of that. So if you're old and you're sick and your roof falls in, you know, it's not very good for you.
Yeah.
There's just no help. So we give them the financial aid to be able to hire a local or a neighbor or someone to help them fix up a leaking roof or to fix a heater that's broken or something like that. What they need now is financial aid. You know, they need that more than anything because they know what they need to get, whether it's heat or medication. I mean, if you can imagine, if someone's sick and they don't have health care like we do here,
yep,
and they need a certain heart medication, that one pill could be, you know, $2 or $3 a pill.
Yep.
So if they do get any kind of, say, a government pension from having worked their whole lives, that pension can be anywhere from $30 a month to $60 a month, or if they're war invalids, that could be like $100 a month. But that $100 or $60 or $30 has to cover medications, food, heating, rent, and all that. So, you know, they have to decide every day, do I buy medication because that one pill could eat up my $30, you know, or do they get heating fuel so they don't freeze? You know, it's a very, very tough life. So when we give them, we try to give them between $100 and $150 a month, which supplements everything so that they can get the medication. They don't have to go without insulin and then get infections and die of something that, you know, is totally preventable, or glaucoma because they can't afford $29 eye drops because that eats up their pension. So we provide them with enough aid at the minimum level to change their lives, literally.
Are both of them living in a couple countries now? What's the geographic layout at the moment of the...
Well, we operate in 8 countries. We operate in Estonia, Lithuania, Belarus, Latvia, Ukraine, Slovakia, Moldova, and parts of Russia. I don't think I left anything out. Mm-hmm. And we might start in Romania soon. So there's a lot of countries there, and we're only in very limited places in Russia, and Russia is vast.
Yeah.
So there's lots of survivors to help, and, you know, there are survivors in Hungary also. There are survivors in Poland. There are survivors all over. Some of them have other groups that help them, or they get more help from governments or German reparations. But for the people that we help, they really don't get German reparations, so that they really don't partake in any of the things that are available to people elsewhere in the world.
The documentary will eventually be able to arrange this being in classrooms or be shown in Europe. What's some of your goals for the one that's online at the moment?
The one that's online at the moment can be shown anywhere. I mean, we've given it to schools. We show it at events to raise money for the survivors. We hope that it touches people so that they, on their own, will donate. And that documentary really tells the whole story of the last survivors of the Holocaust in Eastern Europe and the efforts of the Survivor Mitzvah Project to bring them emergency aid. So anything that you want to know, you can find in this one special, and it's quite moving. So that's why it's there. It's there to educate, inform, and let more people know about the plight of the survivors, because once people know and once people see for themselves, they say, oh, my goodness, I didn't know. How can I help? And that's really what we want. How can I help?
How do you keep in touch with people? You send out a little note once a month, once a quarter. How do you keep in touch with the 2,000 people or so?
Well, what we do is we have a letter. We write letters. In other words, we'll write a letter to them from the beginning, just a letter of introduction if they're new to the project. And then they write back. Then we have an aid application which asks them about their Holocaust history and other questions. And then from there, they start telling us about their lives, and then we tell them about our lives, and it goes back and forth and back and forth, so we can keep proactive with their care. I mean, they might write, you know, I fell down the stairs and I broke my leg. Well, we need to know that immediately so we can get money for them in an emergency situation as well as their monthly stipends, you know. So mm-hmm. every time they write, every time we send them aid, we get a letter back from them, and we don't send more aid until we have that letter translated so that we know what we need to do. You know, there are some people that will say, you know, I'm fine for now. You know, next month I'll need something, you know, or thank you so much. You know, I used it for medications, or thank you so much. I got the heater fixed. Now we don't have to freeze in the winter. So we keep abreast of everything that's going on in their lives so we can help them better. And that's what we do. So the letters range from informational letters to letters of, you know, we tell them about our families. We really include them in our lives just like they're including them, that they include us in their lives. I mean, they consider us a family, and we consider them a family. It's very important to reach out to people. I've noticed from my travels that, you know, we have some people that are very old, like 95 to 105.
Uh-huh.
And we have people in their late 70s, and most of them in their mid-80s and early 90s. And the ones who are connected to someone, whether it's by letter or they have a friendly neighbor or they have one relative, they live longer and they're healthier. But the ones that are alone, totally isolated from anything, they get sick and they die, you know.
Yeah.
And it's only because of a lack of human contact and a lack of hope. Once you give someone hope and you give them friendship and you give them some kindness and compassion, you literally change their lives.
Tender, loving care.
It's exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing that replaces that.
Yeah.
Nothing.
You ever try to set up a little reunion? I mean, if you had 3 or 4 or 5 within a 50-mile radius when you're over there, you try to do it as a group once in a while, or is it all individual?
It's all individual. The distances are just too great. It's literally all individual. And
yeah.
If there is a town where there are more than one survivor living, they know each other already.
Uh-huh.
But in terms of doing things in between villages and towns, I mean, the distances are too great, and there's no public transportation.
So that's probably, you could probably write a book just on your experience of trying to get to one location to another.
It's unbelievable, yes, yes. We drive a lot when we get over there. In this last trip to Belarus, I mean, we spent hours and hours in a van because, you know, we're not going to the major cities.
Yeah.
We go to some major cities, but, you know, on the back roads where there aren't, you know, highways or anything like that, it takes a long while to travel. But we found a lot of new people to the program in these little villages that, you know, we just, like, found them and said, okay, we're here to help you. And they just lit up. They were just like, oh, my God, I can't believe this. So we brought a lot of new people into the program, and we continue to do that because time is running out, you know?
The people that help you here, you guys get to go once a week. How do you maintain the structure?
We have an office downtown L.A., and we have some wonderful volunteers and a short staff that works part-time on different days,
mm-hmm.
so that we have multilingual people who are in charge of the letter and the letter writing and the letter archives, and so we can, you know, they can keep abreast of what's going on with these survivors and when we're due a letter, and then we write letters and they translate them for me. And then we have people who are volunteers all over the place who, you know, spread the word on their Facebook pages, on their Twitter accounts, because right now it's really a call to action. We can do something if everybody just says, okay, I'll help. You know, whether it's $10 or $10,000, it all helps.
Have you found any other group that you could bond with to help find other resources? Have you made...
Well, you know...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. You know, when I came back originally on my first trip, I thought, well, this is a no-brainer. I'll just call up some of the big organizations. I'll tell them who I found. I'll give them the list of the people, and I'll start donating to that organization. But what I found is that there is no other organization that gives them direct financial aid. So then I said, oh, my goodness, there's really a need for this. So we had to start our own 501c3, which is a nonprofit organization, and make sure that every penny that came in went directly to the survivors. So that's what we do. And, you know, donations go directly into their hands because we don't want to take out a big administration fee like a lot of big charities do. We want to keep everything, you know, close to the bone so we can help as many people as possible.
you want to be close to that 95 to 100% as possible to get to take care of people.
Absolutely, yeah. Because, you know, when you see them and you say to yourself, my goodness, what I spend on parking, you know, sometimes,
yep.
You know, would save someone's life, you really realize how every penny counts, you know, you realize how every penny counts and how urgent it is to help them. You know, it's absolutely urgent. And it's interesting also, just knowing for them that someone cares is so much a part of their welfare because, for example, in 2008, during the economic downturn, well, you know, news reaches overseas as well. And so we had many, many survivors writing, you know, we hear that, you know, your country is bankrupt, that everyone is poor now. You know, this is what they hear.
Yeah.
So please, please don't worry about sending us money, but let's not lose the connection. Please keep writing, you know.
Yeah.
So we know that that connection with the letters and with the phone calls is absolutely key. You know, it's as life-saving as the aid, but the aid right now is the most important thing because we have the rest of it covered. You know, we need more help to bring more people aid. So, you know, we're trying to raise like $2.4 million this year so that we can help a variety of people in a very, very big way. We have people waiting for heart surgeries, waiting, you know, for eyesight surgeries, waiting for insulin, waiting for medications. And that shouldn't be. We should be able to absolutely take care of everybody with the kindness and compassion that's in the hearts and souls of all the American people that are out there listening.
That got to be hard, though, to make a priority. Which one do you give first of your $2.4 million budget, you know?
Well, that's really, really a very, very good comment. You know, sometimes right now, like we raised over $600,000 last year.
Yeah.
That was the most we've ever raised because it all comes from small donations from individuals. Very few, you know, we don't have any corporate sponsors and we don't have any big grants. We have a couple of grants.
Right.
But it's all from individuals. So, like, you know, we have to decide, like, you know, is her eyesight more important than his, you know, heart surgery?
Yep.
Her, you know, and it's a terrible thing. We don't want to be in that situation. We want to be able to help everybody because they deserve all the help they can get after what they've been through.
Well, it could be a sleepless night for you because you have a personal relationship with each one of them.
I know. It's something else. It's like having, like, you know, thousands of grandparents.
Yeah.
But you do. You get a personal relationship. I mean, I know all the survivors in Lithuania and in Belarus and in Ukraine, the ones that we help. And, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of survivors in Moldova that I do not know because I haven't been there yet.
Uh-huh.
And so that'll be amazing to meet them. Because once you meet them, you know, they're so unforgettable, each and every one of them. You know, it's not a name on a list. It's a human being, you know. It's a human being. And what I've noticed that really just keeps me going is that I've never met any one of them that was bitter, and I've never met any one of them who doesn't believe that kindness and compassion are the most important things in life, and that's the philosophy that they live by.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them was saved, in a way, by an act of kindness from a stranger.
Right.
Every one of them. A piece of bread was thrown their way. Someone hid them for a night. Someone didn't tell the Nazis. Someone did something kind for them. And because these people have no possessions, all of their pictures were burned, all of their, you know, musical instruments were burned, letters, anything that they had from the past, totally burned. They don't really believe in things. They believe in kindness and interactions between people. So it's a really good lesson to remember that, you know, the interactions between people are the most important things in life. One woman said something funny. She said, you know, at the end of your life, you're not going to be lying on your deathbed thinking, oh, I should have bought more furniture. You know? you're going to be thinking, oh, why didn't I call my friend?
Uh-huh.
Why didn't I see my cousin? Why didn't, you know, those are the things that are important, this interaction between people. And one woman who's very, very poor, she said, you know, if someone's in trouble, just put a kind hand on a shoulder. Say a kind word. That's all you have to do if you can't help them monetarily, you know? But if you can help with money, of course, you know, that's something that is just, you know, life-saving at the moment.
You have met some of the rescuers over the years, too.
Yes.
Have you documented any of their stories?
Yes, some of them. These are amazing people, and they all literally say the same thing. You know, why did you do it? You know, and they all say because it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And what's amazing about these rescuers is if you can imagine, you're in a tiny village and there's 10 huts, okay?
Yep.
Hut number one, they're killing Jews. Hut number two, they're part of the German, you know, extermination.
Yep.
Hut number three, they're hiding three Jewish children. Hut number four, you know, they're saving one Jewish woman. So these are small villages where they had the same parish, they had the same upbringing, they had the same education or lack of education. So it's really the same roots, and yet some people helped and some people were bystanders and some people were perpetrators. So it's always interesting to try to figure out why, you know, why is goodness inherent in certain people and not in others, you know?
I remember in college taking the class, the altruistic personality.
Yes, the altruistic personality is a very interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
Because when, you know, they always say it was the right thing to do. Because in 1939, you know, to 1945, helping a Jewish man, woman, or child was punishable by death. So there are, you know, countless stories about someone, you know, throwing a piece of bread to a Jewish child, mm-hmm. and then their whole family was hung. You know, men, women, and children was just hung in the town. So you took your life in your hand to be a rescuer, you know, and the lives of not only yourself, but of your children and your parents. So it was really something to be a rescuer. Today, we can be rescuers, and it doesn't impact us at all. You know, there's no danger. All we have to do is go click on our computer, and you can rescue someone. So it's a very different mindset, equally as important, but the people who risk their lives and the lives of their families to help, like a starving child, that's just amazing to me.
Talk about the long term of the big documentary. Is that going to be down to financing, or is it going to be a matter of time? How are you going to pull that?
Both. I mean, with the proper financing, we can get a team of editors working on that at the same time.
Yeah.
And I would be able to work with each. Maybe we'll divide it into countries, you know.
Yeah.
And really pare away things that are not important, and then edit down the visits and the life histories and the locations that are important. Like last trip, we found some little villages that where they killed all the Jewish inhabitants, and their houses were half burned, but they were still there. So, like, you know, you go in and there's like a bed with some bedclothes on it. You know, it was just like a ghost town. And these things are falling down now, so it's important that we document them and get them on film, or the last wooden synagogue that fell down since we filmed it. You know, things that will never come again, things that are being paved over, things that are being erased, things where developments are being put up over a cemetery. You know, we've got the footage of this, so we're really reaching out and seeing, you know, are there benefactors out there? Are there people interested in education who would fund this and help us make this a lasting legacy and document it for future generations?
Generally, how do you show it in person? Do are there a group that contacts you and say, Zane, we'd love to have you come and do a presentation? How do you handle that part of your schedule?
Yeah, people either call or they write to through the website, and if they'd like to like show it at their school, or, you know, host what we call a salon event in their house, mm-hmm. where people would invite their friends and family members and maybe, you know, 60 people or something like that, or 30 people to their home and show the last survivor's echoes from the Holocaust, you know, they can do that, and we can send them the materials, the fundraising materials that go along with that screening.
Mm-hmm.
And in certain instances, I would come out and do a Q&A after it. It all depends on scheduling.
Yeah. Okay, so let's figure, how can we help first? Should we go to the website? How can people help you right now?
Well, go to the website. If you want to watch The Last Survivor's Echoes from the Holocaust, that will give you a big overview of what we do. Otherwise, you can just go to the website, read about the project, you know, click around, and donate. There's a donate button right there. They can text to donate, they can donate online, they can send a check. And please tell your family and friends, and if you liked what you see on the website, forward the website to your family and friends. Talk about it on Facebook. Tweet about it. The most important thing to do now is to spread the word, because the more people know about this, the more people will help. And right now, that's what these people need, help. And, you know, with the millions of people who are interested in helping, we just have to get to them to let them be aware that this is going on right now. The plight of the survivors, you know, is life and death again. And they can help. Just click to help, donate to help, spread the word, tweet, you know, Facebook, do anything you can to help, or call us or email us, and we'll give you links to spread around on your Facebook page, links of short videos that there's a 3-minute video that's wonderful that is very emailable and can tell people all about the Holocaust. If you just Googled Zane Busby, Why We Go, a video will pop up that's about a 3.5-minute video that shows all of the survivors and how we help them. And that's a great thing. But you can contact us, and we'll give you the tools to reach out to other people.
Sure.
Please join on Facebook. Join Friends of the Survivor Mitzvah Project. You know, friend us, you know, become part of that group, and you'll receive all of our newsletters and all of our updates.
So, what's the website again for people to go to?
It's Survivor Mitzvah. So that's spelled MITZVAH. So SurvivorMitzvah.org.
And there's an office phone number that people can call to the LA office?
Yes, they can call either 213-622-5050. That's 213-622-5050 or 800-905-6160. 800-905-6160. And we'll be happy to talk to them and give them all the information that they need.
Zane, thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much.
And we'll keep in touch. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye.